Good morning. Or it's afternoon. It's instinctual. I stand up in front of church and greet people. It's good morning. Yeah. Welcome to Faith Lutheran Church. My name is Ben. It's my joy to serve as the pastor here and to welcome you on what is All Souls Day. In Spanish, it's known as Día de los Muertos. But throughout the church, it's a day of celebration to remember all the loved ones who have died and who we as Christians believe are still alive in Christ. And in fact, many of you probably celebrated Halloween. I always like to point out that Halloween was originally All Hallows' Eve. November 1st is All Saints' Day, when we celebrate all the saints. There is no better day to gather and to discuss the topic of how it is that we prepare to die. Because there is one fact in life, which is that we will die. My faith is that we need not fear death. We need not fear death because we have a God who promises us life beyond it. So if we don't need to fear death, preparing for it actually allows us to live life more fully. And so I am so grateful that we have this group of panelists here today who are going to talk to us in four very different fields, how it is that we can prepare for death so that we can more fully enjoy the life that we have now. To start us off, we have two guests to talk to us about hospice. On the far end, we have Sandy Koshel Galka. Now, Sandy graduated from Chico State in 1987. She started out in med-surg at Chico Community Hospital and assumed charge nurse role for about 10 years. The next 10 years included hospital relief supervisor, dialysis, occupational health, and then assisted living, where she acted as the admit RN and community outreach for Wind Chime of Chico. The last 10 years have been spent at the Feather River Hospice House, where she managed the building, the staff, admissions, and daily operations. Her love of hospice came from her experience in assisted living, where she saw the relationships between the hospice team with the patient, family, and the staff. Since the campfire and the closing of the hospice house, she has been blessed with a new position as community outreach RN for Enlo Hospice. So let's give her a warm round of applause. And we have next to her, her colleague, Lindsay Hannon. Lindsay is a medical social worker for Enlo Home Care and bereavement coordinator for Enlo Hospice. Lindsay received both a bachelor's and a master's degree in social work from Chico State University. Lindsay's internship included Oroville Medical Center and Enlo Home Care and Hospice, leading to a career as a medical social worker with 4 years of combined experience in the field, previously having been in management and supervision outside of the medical field for 12 years. Lindsay transitioned to medical social work after her many years in management led her to pursue higher education. Lindsay completed grief and loss training from Beyond Loss at Glendale Adventist Medical Center in 2016 as a certified bereavement facilitator. A round of applause for Lindsay, please. Now, to kick us off, we're going to be asking each of our panelists in just under 2 minutes what it means for them to die a good death as a way of introduction. So you get to know them a little better, and they, I think, have agreed to do a statement on what it means to die a good death. Which one of you would like to go? All right, there's a microphone right there, if you wouldn't mind. It's on, just hold
it.
Are
we on? Perfect. Okay. I'm going to reiterate the statement that there's one thing we can count on, and that is that we are all going to die. So our goal in hospice is to really take the fear out of that whole concept. Hospice is a scary word for a lot of people. But here's the thing. If we are going to die, we want it to be a good death. And part of that is comfort, taking the fear out of the fear of being in suffering, with pain, difficulty breathing, you know, anxiety, all the symptoms that come along with that process. Hospice is the agency that helps bring relief to those symptoms. The other part of it, it should be full of dignity. You should still feel respect and value at the end of your life and through that dying process. And then probably most importantly, it should have quality. And quality is different for everyone. I would rather have a shorter quality life versus a long, not good quality life. Quality would be, who's with you? Do you have your family with you? Are you enjoying that last chapter of your life? Or are you spending it going in and out of the hospital every other day, running to the doctor's office, getting another lab test, only to spend the last chapter of your life busy? So comfort, dignity, and quality should be part of that last chapter and make it a good death and a peaceful death.
Thank you, Sandy. We can pass the mic down to Dane. Dane Bracewell is the funeral director and embalmer at Newton Bracewell Funeral Home. He graduated from the American River College Funeral Service Education Program, and he enjoys sharing his knowledge of all aspects of funeral service with schools, churches, and other groups and organizations, which presumably is why he is here today. He is happy to serve the community in which he was born and raised. A warm welcome for Dane, please. And Dane, in just a couple brief minutes, what does it mean for you to die a good death?
Well, I think we're probably going to echo a lot of the same points here, of course. But the main theme I would stress is, like Sandy said, is dignity. I think there's probably a couple different ways of looking at it, mentally and physically. Mentally, we want to know that our life meant something. We want to have lived a good life and maybe made an impact on the world around us. And then physically, we want to probably die at an older age. We want, generally, people like to be at home rather than at a hospital or at a care facility. And that's why hospice is so important. we would be nice if we had family around us at our side and to die without pain. Those are the big points that I kind of think of what the American dream really is of how to die a good death and to not put a burden on our family and to not put a emotional burden as well as a financial burden. And I think we'll probably touch more on the financial part later in the talk here. So that's it.
Thank you, Dane. And if you wouldn't mind passing that down to Nicole. We are blessed to have Nicole Plattel. Did I pronounce that correctly?
No.
Plattel. Thank you.
I married it, so.
Yeah. Blessed to have Nicole Plattel here, who is a certified elder law attorney, as well as certified specialist in estate planning, trust, and probate law, making her one of 15 dual certified elder law attorneys in California. Ms. Plattel is the managing partner of Harris and Plattel, LLP, and focuses her practice in the areas of elder law, estate planning, long-term care planning, and estate administration. Ms. Plattel is accredited by the Department of Veterans Affairs to represent and present veterans claims. She is also a lay member of the Incapacity Committee, a subcommittee of the Executive Committee of the Trust and Estates section of the State Bar of California. As such, she is actively involved in the review and analysis of proposed legislation affecting California's elderly and those with special needs. She also volunteers her time with the Alzheimer's Association by serving on the Public Policy and Advocacy Committee for Northern California. Additionally, she serves as a board member for the Enloe Medical Center's Enloe Foundation, as well as the Gateway Science Museum's Committee Advisory Board and the Chico Community Scholarship Association. A warm welcome for Nicole, please. And Nicole, what does it mean for you to die a good death?
Well, this isn't a legal answer by any means. I think what it means to die a good death is to have lived a good life. So I work with a lot of people at various stages at the end of their life, and family, community. Nobody looks back and wishes they had worked a couple more hours a day at the office or earned a little more in their paycheck. So trying to live that fully while you can. From a legal aspect, I think having a plan in place helps your loved ones go through that post-death process much easier, but mostly just living a good life.
Thank you, Nicole. And last but not least, we have the Reverend Mary Kearns. Now, Mary serves as a hospice chaplain for Bristol Hospital. She is a board-certified chaplain with the Association of Professional Chaplains, a death and grief specialist, educated through the Center for Loss and Life Transition in Fort Collins, Colorado. She has hosted support groups focused on specific bereavement losses since 2014. She works closely with the Shalom Free Clinic, Enloe Hospice, and Feather River Adventist Health. She facilitates a free support group for survivors of the campfire through a program called Resilience Resources. A warm welcome for Mary, please.
So as a hospice chaplain, my job is to help people be spiritually at peace when they are approaching death. And spirituality is a very broad field. To incorporate that, you need to get to know your patients. And not everyone has a one thing fits all. And so you enter into relationship with these people. You find out what comforts them spiritually. Sometimes you make the phone calls to make those things happen. And sometimes you hold space with people who are actively dying and they don't want to be alone. It is possible to have a beautiful death. And as a hospice chaplain, I can tell dozens of stories of what that looks like. But primarily, being at peace spiritually, I think the thing I run into the most is when people make the distinction between, I'm not giving up, I'm letting go. And that's when they can ease into accepting that they are an end of life. And when that little change in mindset happens, then we can start asking, you know, the questions, what was most meaningful to you? What was most important? What do you love? What are you leaving behind? What's the most important thing you want to say to your family while you still can? And so we initiate these conversations. And so helping people have a peaceful death spiritually, that's what I primarily do as a hospice chaplain.
Thank you, Mary. All right, if you wouldn't mind passing that back down to the end of the table, we're going to let each of our panelists give us a 15-minute answer now of, you've heard what it means for them to die a good death. What can we do to prepare to die a good death within their field of expertise? So we'll start off with hospice. Sandy and Lindsay, how can hospice and medical decisions around the end of life prepare us to die a good death?
You're taking the first step today. Getting information is, this is great that you're here. I get to talk to the majority of our families and patients that we deal with at the very end of their life when they're in crisis mode. They've already been diagnosed with a terminal disease and they may only have a few days or a few weeks to live. And they're trying to make these decisions. It's not a good way to go about it. And it's because in our culture, we don't like to talk about death when we're healthy and well. And unfortunately, we wait till we have to deal with it, and then we don't make good decisions because we're in crisis. So find out about hospice. The basics are that if you, it doesn't have to come into the picture just when you're actively dying. Medicare covers hospice 100%, and it's a team that comes in to surround you in your home or in assisted living or in a skilled nursing facility, wherever you've decided to live. And a nurse case manager will manage your care to make sure that your symptoms are managed. Then we have a home health aide that comes in and helps keep you clean. Make sure that you've got clean sheets and that your family has got support with just taking care of custodial needs in your care. We've got social workers that come in and support and bring all the information about services in the community that can come in and add to that process. Chaplain, volunteers, it's a whole team that surrounds you and your family, everybody that's involved in your care, to make sure that not only you're taken care of, but that your family is supported, taught, coached, and given all the tools that they need, everything from a hospital bed to medication and services in the community to help with that. So if you wait till the very last minute, and now we're trying to bring all that into your home, the last few days of your life are nothing but chaos. Mm. If you think about this ahead of time and you seek out support, hospice can come into the picture 6 months before you pass away. And then it can be extended. You know, we have some people on hospice for over a year and sometimes even longer than that, because you qualify based on a diagnosis, and I won't bore you with all of those details. But I would say don't be afraid of hospice, because if hospice can come into the picture for 6 months of the last part of your life, I guarantee you, you will have a much better last chapter that has more quality with less chaos versus quantity, because you're in and out of a hospital getting medications, antibiotics, and extending your life, but not really enjoying that chapter. And here is the thing, is there's so many choices that you get to make on this. And again, hospice will bring all the information, but they don't make the decisions for you. It's unlike any other field of medicine, where it brings the dignity of your choices. We provide all the information and the coaching, and then let you make the decision. Even if we think it's not a good choice, we'll support you in it.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about how you can kind of prepare for this in advance, so you don't feel like you're having to make all of these decisions right at the last minute, or have your family members have to make these decisions blindly for you. So as a social worker, I wear a couple different hats. As was mentioned, I'm the bereavement coordinator for hospice, but I'm also out with home care. And I go out and do home visits with family members and patients who have just gotten out of the hospital because they had a pretty significant situation happen. And so one of the things I talk to folks about when I'm out in the home is, do you have an advance directive in place? And let's talk about what that is. Let's demystify what it is, so on and so forth. So oftentimes people immediately say, oh yes, I have that in place. Or they'll say, yeah, it's on my refrigerator. And they know that I don't want chest compressions or something along those lines. And I say, oh, okay, so let's actually break this down. There's a big difference between an advance directive and a do not resuscitate, known as a DNR. Some people will have a pulsed on the refrigerator, and that stands for Physician's Order for Life-Sustaining Treatment. So a physician's order for life-sustaining treatment and a DNR, those are doctor's orders. Those are things that have to have a doctor's signature to make them binding. An advance directive, what I tell people is, that's more of a guide that you would utilize, or the medical establishment would utilize, in the event that you present to the hospital unconscious or not cognitively intact enough to make appropriate decisions on your own. The advance directive is a document that allows you to name up to 3 people who we'll call agents, who will be making decisions on your behalf when you cannot. So the difference there is that this is a document that does not need a doctor's signature on it to make it legally binding. You can be as detailed as you want in an advance directive. Also, I just want to reiterate that an advance directive is also known as a durable power of attorney for healthcare. Again, meaning you've named somebody to be your voice in the event that you cannot vocalize your wishes. So you can be as detailed as you'd like in that advance directive. You can be as detailed as you want. Basically, it's a place for you to say, this is how I want things to go in the event that I can't share my wishes. I don't want chest compressions, or I want the full bore. I want them to do everything they can to save my life and keep me going. I want them to hook me up to every machine they can. You have that right to make that choice, but you need somebody to be your voice in that situation. There's some confusion about that, because some people will ask, well, what happens when you know, maybe I've recovered or I'm back to a cognitively sound place, I'm no longer unconscious, then you're back to being the decision maker again. That advance directive only gets initiated when you cannot share your wishes. So back to the hospice piece, we really try to help people get advance directives in place prior to hospice or when they come onto hospice, because it's pretty inevitable that when you're in the end of life phases, there will come a point where you're not responsive, most likely. And again, we want to be able to turn to one of your family members or whoever your agent is that you've assigned to help make those decisions on behalf of you and what your wishes are. The other piece is that when you decide to get an advance directive in place, you want to talk to those agents that you've chosen. You don't want them to be in the dark about this. That happens sometimes, and so family members or friends will suddenly be called and go, oh my goodness, I did not know that I was the chosen one. So have a discussion with those folks in your life that you're choosing. Make sure that they're comfortable with this, because you don't want somebody making decisions for you that is not comfortable with the idea of doing that for you. And then really make those wishes known to that person so that they can go into a situation with confidence, knowing that they're actually carrying out your wishes on your behalf. In order to make an advance directive legally binding, it's relatively simple. You can either have it notarized, or you can have it signed by two witnesses that are not the agents you've chosen. I often tell folks, do you have a spirituality? Do you have a church or congregation you can lean into? Find some folks that you know there that you haven't chosen as an agent and have them sign as witnesses. They're basically signing to say you're of sound mind and you're making appropriate decisions. Again, though, you can have it notarized. And there's mobile notaries that come to the home, or you can go to the notary. Last but not least, what's most important here is once you've got that advance directive in place, most people just throw it in the safe and that's the end of that, and that's not going to do you any good. So I tell people, when you have your advance directive looking just like you want it and it's signed or notarized, give copies to your agents. Give a copy to your primary care physician, but most importantly, give a copy to the hospital. So that way, if there's an emergency situation, there's no floundering over what's going to happen and who's going to be your agent. If you can get it into the medical records, it'll make it into your chart. And then when you're at the hospital, they'll be able to look in there and say, okay, there's an advance directive here in place, and they want us to call their daughter, their spouse, their whoever, to start making medical decisions for them. How am I doing on time here?
Couple minutes.
I'm good. Okay. So it sounds relatively simple. I guess probably the hardest part is really starting to think about what it is that you want to do or what wishes you want to set forward and in motion for your agent to know about. So as a social worker, I can't not talk about the quality of life piece. So oftentimes I help a lot of people in home care transition to hospice because they've been faced with a terminal diagnosis and they're trying to figure out and grapple with what to do next and what are their options. And I think that at a time like that, you're faced with so many things to think about. How's my family going to respond to this? Are they going to support me if I don't necessarily want aggressive treatment anymore? Or perhaps you do want aggressive treatment. Oftentimes when I sit with folks, I put my hands out and I say, in this hand, you are looking at aggressive treatment, treatments that might involve going to the cancer center or infusion center 5 days a week. You want everything done to help make as much time out of your disease process as possible. And in this hand, you decide, I want to be home, I want to be comfortable, I want to be with my loved ones, I want to look out the window and enjoy the flowers growing in my yard. And imagine a continuum in the middle of those two hands. Where do you land in that decision-making process? Some people land right in the middle. They want some treatment, but they don't want it to be incredibly aggressive because they still want a little bit of quality of life. Some folks want to be on one end. Some folks want to be kind of 75% of one side or the other. That's the stuff you want to start thinking about in regards to the disease process or a diagnosis that comes along so that you can kind of work through what's important to you. Some of the questions I ask folks when they're kind of in that place of grappling is, what is your true understanding of the illness that you have? What is your understanding of the prognosis of this disease process, so that you can kind of start thinking about what will the aggressive treatment look like? Do I really want to have that kind of aggressive treatment? What are your fears and worries about the future? Because you have to still consider not only yourself, but your family members and how they're going to respond to this disease process, how they're going to be responding to being a caregiver for you if you're going to decide to stay home. What are your goals and priorities going forward? Here's a big question I often ask. What outcomes are unacceptable for you, and what are you willing to sacrifice or not sacrifice in the final days of your life, or in the wake of getting a terminal diagnosis? And lastly, what does a good day look like to you? And are you achieving that in having all of this treatment or not having all of this treatment? Like we've said a couple times here today, there is a 100% chance that we are all going to die. So it's something we can't escape. It's not an easy subject to talk about, but again, to circle back to what Sandy said, preparedness is a huge part of making the transition as smooth as it can be. It will be a little bumpy. It's your end of life. You want to make it special, and you want to make it good, have good quality. So.
All right. Thank you. So to recap a few things I heard, one is to say that hospice is really a team of folks that come and gather around you and your family at the end of your life to help you manage everything from the medical challenges to the emotional challenges. And you said Medicare actually covers it. That's great. And then I heard you say, the importance of having an advance directive that explains who's going to make those decisions when you're not capable of making decisions. Yes. And that you should actually tell the people that they're your agents for that.
Yes, that's a good idea.
Plan. And then I also heard you say, make sure you don't just keep it in a safe, like take it to Enlo.
Yes.
And make sure they have a copy on file.
And that goes for also your do not resuscitate or a DNR or a POLST as well. Any of those documents, if perhaps you only have a DNR in place or a POLST in place at this time, it's good to have it on file with the hospital so that they know maybe you have elected not to have chest compressions. Let's try to prevent that from happening then. If you're unconscious and you present to the hospital and you don't have a loved one with you who maybe is your agent or who can speak on your behalf to say, I know that my grandmother doesn't want this, or I know my mom doesn't want chest compressions, have that POLST or that DNR on file with the hospital. Same with the advance directive.
Perfect. And I guess the last thing I heard both of you really encourage us to think about is, what do we want those last days to look like? Yeah. Do we want them to be focused on medical procedures to extend our life as much as possible, or do we want to have more time spent in a peaceful location at home? And to say that's a tough balance for people to consider, but to spend time now considering it. Well, a round of applause for Sandy and Lindsay, please. All right, Dane, what happens to our bodies after we die? Oh, we have a question. So, Margaret, I will encourage you to say, after the panelists have all spoken, each of them are going to be available for us to talk to and ask questions to directly. So I encourage you to hold on to those questions until you get a chance to talk to them one-on-one. Thank you, though. So, Dane, what happens to our bodies after we die, and what preparations can we do before we die around what happens to our bodies to make our death as good as possible, not just for ourselves, but for our loved ones?
Thank you. The first part of that question is quite a broad question, because there's so many various circumstances around how somebody might possibly die, as far as that could change that question. We die oftentimes at our homes, on hospice, at a hospital, care homes, or maybe an unattended coroner's-related death where there's no doctor involved, maybe it was an accident, something of that nature. And those things all change what happens to our body, of course, after we die. When the person is on hospice or in a hospital, obviously the death is found out about quite quickly, and usually the funeral home is able to come to the facility and bring that person back into our care quite quickly, which makes our job quite a bit easier. But sometimes the deceased is not found for some time. People living alone that maybe don't have a life alert or don't have somebody there to watch them or make sure that they're cared for and might have died unexpectedly. And sometimes that changes the things, of course, as far as how our body progresses after death. Things that we as a funeral home feel like there's a lot of value in the body. And that's one of the biggest parts of what we do, of course, is dealing with the deceased. And I include myself in this as well. So often as Christians, we feel like my soul is in heaven and doesn't matter what happens to me afterwards, just bury me in the backyard or cremate me and I don't care what happens to my ashes. But I feel like there is value in the body, and not just from my profession, but from my faith as well. When Jesus died on the cross, they didn't just cast his body aside. They wanted his body. They took it. They bathed it. They wrapped it in cloth. They put perfume on it, and they buried him in a tomb. And there was value in that. They saw the value in his body, and I obviously we're not Jesus, but I still see the value of who you left behind and them caring for that body, and this is my mom, this is the person, or my dad, or my grandma, this is the person I loved, and I cared, and I hugged, and I kissed. So there still is value in that body, whether you choose cremation, or burial, or whatever it is that you choose to do afterwards, there's still value there. Even for just a simple cremation, we often invite families to bring clothing in for us to dress the body in, because even though nobody's probably going to see that person before the cremation, from a mental aspect, thinking about maybe a few years down the road, what was my loved one buried in, or what were they cremated in, what were they wearing, to give them that dignity and that respect. Something that people often are confused about is embalming. And that's obviously the care of the body after the death. Embalming is not required by law. It used to be something that was done all the time because we didn't have technology that we do nowadays as far as refrigeration and keeping the body cool. Keeping the body cool slows down decomposition so that we could avoid embalming in some instances. And so it's nice that we have the technology to be able to present more options for families and for the deceased. Back when my dad first started in the business 40 years ago, we didn't have refrigeration and they would embalm everybody. 2 o'clock in the morning, he would go on a removal and they would have to do the embalming right then and there in the middle of the night. Within 24 hours of bringing somebody into our care, we can either keep them cool in refrigeration or we can embalm. And after embalming, they don't have to be in cool storage anymore. So that's definitely a common question. Also, really, what is embalming, of course? Embalming is the use of preservatives through the circulatory system in order to preserve the body. In some instances, it is still necessary nowadays. It's not as common as it used to be, of course, but we still do it quite often. We do it when we're having a viewing that's an extended period of time. If there's a viewing maybe under 30 minutes, then there's sometimes not a need for embalming. But if it's longer than that, if you're inviting the public and it's going to be an open casket viewing for an hour or 2 hours or longer maybe, then that's when embalming is really necessary to preserve the body, to not be in that cool storage for an extended period of time. As well as to sanitize and bathe and clean the body and make it look better, make it look more presentable. The use of the preservatives actually gives the body kind of a lighter, kind of a pinkish tone, kind of like you're used to seeing. That after you pass away, your circulatory system is no longer working and blood is not flowing through your body. And so that's why you become pale. And so we can use dyes in the preservative fluids in order to be able to give you that natural pinkish tint that you're used to seeing on the person. If anybody has more detailed questions on embalming, I'd be happy to answer those at the end at my little table over here. But I, as far as people that don't want to hear that, I'm not going to get too detailed. But one of the best things that I feel like you can do is pre-planning. Something that hospice didn't touch on as far as the advanced directive is something that actually continues after death. And that's something that can be used. It actually has a section in either a durable power of attorney for healthcare or an advanced directive where it actually gives that agent the right to control disposition after death. And so that's something we thank hospice all the time for getting these documents in place and helping people to get that. And highly recommend that to anybody, especially in these times where our families are splintered, where our children live all the way across the countries, different places, and having one agent that can make all those decisions, that can sign all that paperwork, makes our job quite a bit easier at the end. We have many situations where there's, the family hasn't spoken with the brother or sister for years. They're splintered. They don't have a good relationship, and maybe the spouse and the children have passed away, and now that sibling is in control, and they don't want control. And so, if you're that kind of a, you have that kind of a relationship where you're not have a lot of family, maybe find a friend or somebody that could take that power of attorney or that advanced directive. I'm sure Nicole will talk more about power of attorney stuff here in a little bit, so I won't get too detailed, but that is an important part of pre-planning in the funeral process because that makes things quite a bit easier for us. Also, as far as pre-planning, you can pre-plan your funeral arrangements, and that's could be just as simple as just writing some notes down on a piece of paper and making sure your family has that and making sure whoever is going to be in charge knows what you want to be done. It doesn't have to be as detailed as coming to the funeral home, but because everybody's different, some people want to have all those plans in place. And so you can go one step further and actually meet with the funeral home. Recommend talking to funeral homes and finding one that you trust, that you feel like is going to be the best for carrying out your wishes and taking good care of you and your family at that time. And pre-planning can be anywhere from sitting down with the funeral home and just kind of picking out some options, saying, yes, I want burial, or maybe I want cremation, and this is the urn I want to be placed in, this is the casket. I want to have a funeral service, or maybe I'm not sure if I do want one. Maybe I don't have as many friends and family, and I don't think a lot of people are going to be there, and maybe I just want to have a small family gathering rather than a large open service. So there's so many options out there, and one of the things that we come across quite often is families don't talk about those things because we don't want to assume that we're going to die, we're going to live forever, and families don't often talk about those things, and so it's important for them to just know what you want, and instead of it being a guessing game, and I guess mom wanted cremation, or well, she had this burial plot, so I assume she wants burial, but it helps to get those things in writing, and especially at a funeral home, and have it all picked out. You can pick your songs, you can pick pictures to be used for brochures or for videos. You can even write your own obituary and have it on file, and have an advance directive on file with us so that we have a copy of that as well. All good things that you can definitely do to prepare as you're thinking about end of life. And then the last step would be if you really wanted to make sure there was no financial burden on anybody at the end there, you could actually prepay for all those services, whether it be just a simple cremation with no services or a full service with casket and burial and everything in between. And you can pick those things. Well, maybe I want to be a casket burial, but I don't want viewing. So there are so many different options that you can choose. And we'd be happy to sit down with you and kind of go through that and help you plan that out. And then as far as pre-paying for it, the law requires that if you are prepaying for a service that we're providing, it's not a merchandise, well, there's some merchandise involved, but most of it is a service, we have to make sure that that money is there when your time of need. So we can't take that money and spend it now. We have to actually save that for you, which is there to protect you as the consumer. And so we can either keep it in a trust in the bank or more commonly use an insurance policy. And it's a specific insurance policy for funeral goods and services, and it's just the exact dollar and cents amount of what you what today's costs are. And the big incentive of that is not only to, like I said, not leave a burden on people, but to lock in today's prices so that you're not paying inflated rates down the road. So that's a helpful thing for people as well too. So I think that all of this is a really good way to just make sure that you're prepared and just dying a good death.
Thank you, Dane. And for me to recap a few of the things that really stood out to me.
Sure.
One, I appreciated your good theology on the importance of caring for the body after death. And it sounds like, you know, one of the ways that funeral homes do that is by whether someone dies in a hospital or they die at home, funeral home goes and collects the body and prepares it for whatever form of burial. And I heard you say that even if someone's cremated, that families can pick out clothing for that person to be buried in. And presumably we could pick the clothing we want to be cremated in or buried in ahead of time.
Definitely.
And it sounds like embalming is not necessary, but if people want to have a viewing or that sort of thing, it's helpful.
Definitely.
Yeah. And then I also heard you talk about the importance of planning ahead of time who you want to carry out all your instructions for your funeral, telling them, and that can be part of some of these other legal documents that are prepared ahead of time, as well as, choosing for yourself how you want to be remembered at your time of death, what those services look like. And then I heard you say prepaying ahead of time for funeral services helps not only take the burden off of family members at your time of death, but you can lock in a rate that the cost now versus what they might be in 10 or 20 years. All right. Anything I missed that you want to reemphasize?
Well, just along that point, I mean, it's incredible the difference when you're sitting down with a family where the deceased has pre-planned versus not, and how much of a burden it takes off of the family. Just to reemphasize that a little bit, families are just like, oh, this is it? Everything's all done? Okay, I thought this was going to be a lot harder. And it's one of the best gifts that you can leave to your children is to make sure that is all taken care of. And it's such a crazy, hectic time already because you've been dealing with the person maybe on hospice or in the hospital and trying to deal with their health, and then you're transitioning into grief, and you're obviously not thinking straight, and it's hard to know exactly what to do and what decisions to make, but to have all that pre-planned ahead of time just makes that process a lot easier.
Thanks, Dane. A round of applause. All right, Nicole, how can we prepare legally so that we can die a good death?
So what we do, I kind of break this into sort of three components. Most people think of estate planning as death planning. And to back that up, I think more importantly, it is about life planning. And we've talked a lot about getting ahead of this crisis-driven plan, which is also a plan. I mean, there is a plan in a crisis. It may not be the one you wanted. So in estate planning, we look at management of our affairs while we're alive, first and foremost. That's more important, I think, is making sure that you've got the right tools in place that are going to allow your trusted loved ones to assist you in making decisions, or even just manage affairs at some point in the future. The sort of subpart of that is also making sure that we have sufficient funds to live on during our life and as we age and as the cost of care continues to rise. So making sure we assess how are we going to pay for any future care. I think people have a harder time planning for incapacity than planning for death. So we all know we're going to die, but we have this romantic notion that it's going to be in our home, surrounded by our family. We're going to be lucid up until the very last beautiful moment. And anything short of that is terrifying, to think that we may have a dementia diagnosis or an Alzheimer's diagnosis or even just a diminished capacity, that we may not have all of our faculties as we continue to age. So incorporating that component into our estate plan is what we look at it as a comprehensive approach. And then certainly the post-death side, so having an understanding of what your estate will look like when you pass away. Is it going to have to go through a probate proceeding, or is there, you know, modified proceedings to help expedite that in a lower cost type of setting? So on the estate planning side, again, it's nice to do this ahead of time when death is not knocking on your door. It's also critical to do it while you have capacity, because if we do not have capacity, then you cannot get a healthcare directive. So waiting until the last moment, then that basically assures us that we do have to get the court, the probate court involved for some sort of conservatorship process. So everything that most families would like to avoid, especially in that end of life stage. So just some basic terminology. The estate planning documents, they're all unique. There is no one size fit all document. There are some statutory documents that we have written into our probate code, and even those have some limitations. So I think having a good understanding of what the documents you need are, what they're designed to do, what they say, communicating with your loved ones ahead of time to the degree that you're comfortable, because it is a private private conversation, and then revisiting it as well. So doing an estate plan 20, 30, 40 years ago and telling your children that it's all been taken care of, it may or may not still be valid. It may or may not still, your assets may have changed since then. So reviewing your own estate plan, the documents, reading what they say, dusting them off and finding them and knowing where they are is always a good idea. And the advanced healthcare directive has been talked about a lot, and that's a critical part of what we do. It's one part of what we do, and it should be done as part of the comprehensive full planning, because if we lose capacity to make medical decisions, then we probably aren't going to run down to the bank and make sure our PG&E gets paid either. So making sure you've got management, so that's broken into two types of documents. So the overarching title of that is called a power of attorney, and the key players in that, which is just, it's like a contract. It's just a set of written instructions that you're authorizing an agent to do on your behalf. And so we separate that into financial affairs and then medical decision making. On the financial affairs, those are even more unique than healthcare directives. Not all powers. You could have two types. You could have a springing power of attorney or an immediate power of attorney. And what that means, it has nothing to do with, you know, the seasons changing. It means that your agent does not have the authority to access or manage your finances for you until they prove that you lack capacity. So their authority needs to be sprung into effect. And each document is different. So making sure you understand that, read when the power becomes effective, and what's the process for springing it. Sometimes it's your doctor's statement, sometimes it's two doctors, sometimes it's a whole committee. Each one's going to be unique. The other part is making sure you've got sufficient funds to pay for future care. So having an understanding of your assets and your fixed income. Can you self-insure various levels of care, whether it's you're in your home or in a an assisted living or memory care or skilled nursing? Having that analysis done and sort of playing out all of those what-if scenarios based on current costs of care in our area at the various stages can be, even here in Chico, pretty expensive. Anywhere, you know, up to $18,000 a month for certain types of skilled nursing or even in-home care. So doing that analysis, having an understanding of what does Medicare cover, what does your supplement cover? That's a whole nother topic that people are thrust into at 65, thinking I've finally made it, I get my free Medicare, and then lo and behold, A, it's not free, B, it's really complex, and they don't necessarily cover what you think they cover. Having an understanding of Medicaid, which we call Medi-Cal in California, there's lots of misinformation about that program for the elderly. People call it a poverty program, but there's actually a lot of assets that you can own and still qualify for that benefit without having to spend it down. Veterans have benefits available for certain wartime veterans. So just putting, you know, all of the pieces of the puzzle together ahead of time versus the good idea box. Well, I did this piece over here 20 years ago, and then I did another piece here. You know, so trying to put that puzzle together well ahead of time, so it's comprehensive. And then the post-death side. So I always say that's kind of the easier part, even without a plan. You know, I can look at your assets and tell you what's going to happen to them, whether we have to probate them or not. And, you know, if having, again, if it's a value to you, knowing that your family and your loved ones aren't going to, A, they're going to be grieving. So do you want them to be grieving and trying to pick out your casket, or know whether you wanted to be cremated and you never told them? And then also dealing with lawyers and banks and courts and, you know, so it does get done. We do it. There's a plan in place. If you didn't plan, it's just maybe more burdensome or more expensive for your loved ones. So nowadays we use, you know, trusts, which are pretty popularized, to avoid having that court involvement after death. Trusts, again, are just legal contracts that are unique, just as all of us are unique, and our family dynamics are unique, and our assets are all very different. So getting, knowing ahead of time if you need a trust or just a will, getting your family involved in that decision making, and then certainly getting it reviewed, even if it's just you and your family sitting down at the coffee table, looking at those documents and reading them in sort of as much plain English as you can, to have an understanding of what they mean, or getting them updated as circumstances change. So, yes.
All right. Thank you. So a few things that really stood out to me is this idea that as we prepare to plan for our death, it's actually really important to prepare to plan for our life. And to say, you know, you emphasized how often we overlook the idea that we may be incapacitated for some time before our death, and to have plans in place for who makes decisions in that time, who pays our bills. And then I heard you also talk about this idea of not just doing piecemeal planning of, you know, an advance directive here or some other thing here, but making sure you sit down and look to make sure all the pieces fit together as a plan. Mm-hmm. And then reviewing those every now and then to make sure the law hasn't changed, your family dynamics haven't changed, mm-hmm. and then to tell your family what these things are so that there's not surprises at the end. Yep. Anything else that you want to really highlight?
I think you summarized it better than I did. So.
Well, a round of applause for Nicole, please. All right, Mary, we've heard hospice, you know, how we can take care of each other medically. We've heard about making our funeral preparations. We've heard about estate planning and getting our legal affairs in order. Talk to us about how we can spiritually and emotionally prepare to die a good death.
One of the things that I do with my patients and my families when I start working with them is I ask them the question, and that is, how do you have a beautiful death? And that is possible. That is very, very possible. If you are in a hospice situation, you have a team surrounding you, and a lot of your emotional and legal and medical stuff will be taken care of. But to prepare spiritually, that's kind of, I'm trying to, how do you summarize every world religion and put it down into, no. To prepare spiritually for a beautiful death basically means coming to a level of acceptance. When that diagnosis is given to you and you accept that this is the diagnosis that is going to take me out, whether it be congestive heart failure or cancer or COPD or Alzheimer's or dementia, coming to a level of acceptance that this is the beginning of my death journey, that starts it. Because all of a sudden, the superfluous things of life fall away and you become very focused on what is important. When I'm working with these families, so many of them, I will ask them, what does hospice mean to you, or what does end of life mean to you? And I'll highlight a family I worked with a couple of weeks ago, sweet little old lady with dementia. And I asked her, what does hospice mean for you? And she says, it means my kids are going to all come home. Because that's what she wanted. She wanted to be surrounded by her family, and she was. Family members surrounding their loved one to help them have a beautiful death. What I work with them on is accepting it as well. Acceptance is probably the hardest thing when you know you're going to die. Most of us will enter into end of life, and it's not like ER or Grey's Anatomy or any of the soap operas where they gave you this miraculous drug and your hair grows back and you go on and you marry the guy and everything's all great and peachy. It doesn't work that way at all. And so many family members sometimes are holding out for that miracle. And if they accepted, they could actually be more present with their loved one. This same family where the mom wanted all of her kids, this big family, like 6 adult children, and 4 of them were in the medical field, doctors, nurse practitioners, medical assistants. And these people were constantly taking her pulse and monitoring things and calling our poor nurse and running her ragged. And my very first visit with this family after I assessed was, and I told them, I said, I'm going to tell you something with love, but with a little firmness here. Stop taking your mom's pulse and hold her hand. That's what she wants more than anything. You know, you keeping track of her O2 levels and her respiratory rates, that's not improving her quality of life. You curling around her and telling her, I remember the Halloween costume you made me in 4th grade. That's what she's going to take with her when she crosses over. So a beautiful death starts with accepting that you are going to die. And sometimes it starts in a hospital room when the doctor brings you that information. Sometimes it starts with the hospice admission process. I cannot tell you how many times I've been out on admission and I'm working with families and I ask them, do you know what hospice means, what this is about? And the answer is no. The doctor just said it's time for hospice and they discharged us. And so my colleagues from a different agency, a lot of times we do a lot of education on what end of life means and what that's like. And if you're utilizing the whole team, then you will, you know, hopefully lovingly and skillfully be given information so that you can make those informed choices. As far as our spirituality goes, there are many ways to bring spiritual comfort to families, depending on the religion or world religion or philosophy that the people belong to. I have been in situations where I called every Catholic church in the greater Roseville area trying to find a Spanish-speaking priest to deliver end-of-life, the anointing of the sick and dying for a family where they lived in the Bay Area, went to the Catholic church down there, but a family was up in Roseville and so transferred up to our hospice, and he had not received the anointing of the sick and dying. That's a very important sacrament if you're a Catholic. And so ritual care, that's important, and the chaplains will work really hard to make sure that happens. I also know that I have been with families who have been Catholic for generations, but when a priest cannot be secured, you'd be surprised at how easily a female Protestant will do. And I have done the anointing of the sick and dying for many, many, many patients because it brings comfort to know, you know, those words, that prayer, that anointing, the cross on the forehead, the cross on the hands, the announcement that your sins have been forgiven. That brings deep comfort to some people in that particular faith journey. I've been with other people who had a very religious life, but their diagnosis caught them off guard, and they are mad. They are steaming mad, and Granny, who never said a foul word in her mouth, may be cussing. She is mad, and the family wants to do everything to get her to, oh, stop saying that, but as a chaplain, I walk in, and I'm like, anger is a protest emotion. We protest when we feel helpless and hopeless and frustrated and sad. And we don't stop being angry until we get to vocalize why we feel angry. And so the chaplains, we are these deep listeners to people. This is a woman who needed to process that she didn't get to go on that trip, that she didn't get to do some of those things. She needed a space to process, I have regrets in my life. And as chaplains, we listen and we validate and normalize those feelings. And then once they get that out, you know, there's a perfect little saying, the Swedish have a proverb, a burden shared is half the burden. You cut that emotional angst in half by listening, by letting them get it off their chest. So chaplains do a lot of listening, and people need to talk at end of life. People need to say, this was the most meaningful thing in my life. People need to tell their loved ones that they loved them. They need to hear that from their loved ones. And so chaplains kind of help bring all of those things together when we are working with our patients. One of the most beautiful deaths I saw happened in an ICU when I was working at Phoenix, Banner Good Samaritan. And this was a patient who had been on palliative care. That's the, in the hospital, acute care, you go into the hospital, you broke your leg, they said they cast it, you go home, it heals, acute care. The next level of care is called palliative care. This is a chronic disease that needs a lot of management. It could be chemotherapy, it could be breathing treatments. There's a variety of things that happen with palliative care. The final level of care in American medicine is hospice care, end-of-life care. Well, this was a family. The mom was on palliative care. And the palliative care doctor came to the conclusion that there was no more we could do, and this patient was going to pass. The minute we turned off the machines, natural death would happen. And so they sent me in to talk to the family and help them prepare for this. And the nature of the disease she had, that it would be minutes after we shut off the machines. So I came in there and I started talking to the family and I asked them, tell me about your mom. And they started telling these beautiful stories. The daughter shared this story about how at her wedding, her parents outdanced her and the groom. You know, they were much better dancers, and all of the video footage was of mom and dad. The son told a story of how she believed in him even when he had given up on himself. And the husband was like, I couldn't have done life without her. And so we talked about those things. And then they had a faith tradition, and I asked him, I said, would you like to say a prayer? That is, you know, they were Catholic, and so we said some rosaries and some Our Fathers. And the whole time I was holding the man's hand, and he was just restless. And after a while, I asked him, I said, sir, what's wrong? He says, well, if I understand this process correctly, he says, once we turn these machines off, she's going to pass away. And he's like, and I can't reach her. He says, I want to kiss my bride one last time. Can we lower this bed so I can kiss her? And I said, yes, sir. And I ran out and I grabbed the nurse. I'm like, we got to move some stuff around. We got to do this. And when I told her the story, she started crying. And then everyone in the whole room started crying because this is really deep emotional stuff. And so we were able to lower the bed and get some stuff out of the room. And he leaned over and he whispered her name. And this is a woman who had been in a coma. She woke up. She looked in his eyes. He kissed her. And it was beautiful. It is possible to have a beautiful death if you accept that you will die. Then you have time to surround yourself with what is important. And that is how we do it.
Amen. Thank you, Mary. I don't feel the need to summarize that. That was amazing. A round of applause for all these panelists, please. So if you're anything like me, this has just started your desire to understand more about how to prepare to die a good death. And we are blessed in that these folks are going to be sticking around to help us do that. And so we've got different stations around the edge of the sanctuary for that very purpose. Dane Bracewell is going to be at that table over on that side. In the back corner, one of the things we didn't talk so much about, is to say, you know, there are a variety of options for how you live and care for yourself and your loved ones in the final years of your life. And so we are blessed to have Tina Dewey, there she is, from Community Care Options in that back corner table with the lovely autumn arrangements to help you talk through what those options are. And then Lindsay and Sandy from Hospice Care are gonna be at the other table in the back. And my understanding is you've got stuff there to help people start the process of getting advanced directives, a pulse, those physician orders. So you can start that process today, as well as just learning more about what hospice care means. Over in this side, I have set up a wall, and there are pastels in front of it. And to say, what I'm inviting you to do is to say from, and then insert a name, I remember, and write what it is you remember about that person. Mary so beautifully said, you know, when we accept that we are going to die, we can focus on what matters. And so as we ponder how we want to live our life, I encourage you to think about what it is that you remember from the people that you have loved, what their legacy is for you, so that you can better think about what legacy you want to live for others. And then here at this table, if you want to plan a church service, plan your funeral service here, I've got a form. And if you're a member of Faith Lutheran, we'll stick it in my files so that I know what you want, so that your family doesn't have to plan it. We're also blessed to have Peter over here. Will you wave for us? He's also a hospice nurse, and he's got information on how you write out the legacy that you want to be remembered for you. And then we've also got on this table an email list if you want to sign up for future Sacred Conversations. We have these talks on difficult conversations about once a month to help us dig deeper onto things that we'd rather not talk about but are so blessed when we do. And finally, both Mary and Nicole will be available here so that you can talk with them one-on-one if you want to learn from Mary more about emotional support groups if you are going through grief, or emotional support groups for people who've been survivors of the campfire. And of course, Nicole, if you want to talk about some of those estate planning and other legal things that you can prepare for your death. So I invite you to spend about the next 45 minutes walking around and preparing yourself to die, as Mary said, a beautiful death. Yeah, question, Bill. Thank you, Bill. Yes, indeed. And of course, as we consider preparing for death, we're also mindful of the needs of the bodies of the living. So the bathrooms are through that glass door, straight out. Once more, a round of applause for our panelists. Chilly. Yeah, I guess sitting there and, well, thank you again.